Young. It's Here and Now. The United States and Syria today held the first high-level talks in years during a conference on Iraq's security in Egypt. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said her half-hour meeting with Syria's foreign minister was professional and businesslike, and that neither side lectured the other. The meeting came after the U.S. military in Iraq said Syria has been tightening its borders recently to keep foreign fighters out of Iraq. About 60 countries are attending the Iraq conference in Egypt. Paul Richter of the Los Angeles Times is also there. He joins us on a cell phone from the streets of Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. And Paul, let's start with this meeting with Syria. President Bush chastised Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi when she met with Syrian leaders last month during her trip to the Middle East. He said she was sending the Syrians mixed signals. So why this apparent reversal today with Rice meeting with Syria?
Well, the U.S. is eager to do everything it can to try to get help for its floundering ally, Iraq, and they see this conversation as one more way to do that. Americans say that the Syrians are simply allowing too many foreign fighters across the Syrian border into Iraq. That's the main grievance. They're also unhappy that they think money is coming in across the border to fund militant operations in Iraq as well.
Iran has a delegate at the meeting. Is there a chance that the U.S. will meet with Iran?
Yes, it seems that there may be an exchange of words, but no more than that. In fact, Secretary Rice was at a lunch with the Iranian Foreign Minister Mottaki just a little while ago, and apparently they exchanged pleasantries, but it wasn't more than that, and it appears that there isn't going to be more of a dialogue with the Iranians at this meeting.
You write that the conference is underscoring the rifts in the region. Just lay out a few for us.
As you know, there's been a long-standing divide between the Sunnis and the Shia. At the moment, Shia-led Iran is growing in influence across the region, and that's alarmed the neighboring countries that are led by Sunnis, including the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians.
You remind us that the Sunni ruler of Saudi Arabia wouldn't meet with the Shiite prime minister of Iraq. That can't bode well.
Yes, that was a signal of Saudi unhappiness. The Saudis fear that the Iraqi government is being too tough on its Sunni minority, that they're not protecting them well enough from Shia militias, they're not providing government services to them, they're not inviting enough of them into the government.
We read also that there's a lot of jockeying for position, that, for instance, Egypt wants to get more involved with Iraq because it fears that Syria has gotten too involved. It sounds as if there's some elbowing there.
The Egyptians are the largest Arab country, and traditionally they've had a preeminent role in the region. But recently the Egyptians have been more concerned with internal matters. They've been a little bit less assertive diplomatically, but now it seems they want a larger role.
Well, Iraq is asking these other countries to forgive 80% of Iraq's $56 billion foreign debt. Kuwait, which is a Sunni nation, has already refused to forgive $15 billion in Iraq's debt. The U.S. says Saudi Arabia has privately agreed to forgive 80% of Iraq's $17 billion debt to Saudi Arabia. What do you think overall is going to be the result of Iraq's request?
Well, the Iraqis have been getting pledges for a number of years now from other countries that hold its debt, but many of the countries haven't really delivered. They've made a lot of promises at donors' conferences and really haven't made good on them.
Isn't one of the problems that they face that if the U.S. leaves, the power vacuum in the region means that Iran's going to be the most likely candidate to help out Iraq, and if they don't step up to the plate, Iran will?
That's probably the case, and that's why many of the neighboring countries are really ambivalent about the foreign presence there. Some of them complain publicly about the American presence, but privately they don't want the U.S. to leave because they're worried about what could happen with our departure.
Paul Richter covers the State Department for the Los Angeles Times. He's speaking to us from the streets of Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, about this week's Iraq conference there. Paul, thanks so much.
Glad to do it.
Quick, name the 10 Republicans campaigning for their party's presidential nomination. Well, that's okay if you can't. Just as many Americans got to know former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel during the Democrats' debate last week, tonight many will become aware of Republican Representative Ron Paul of Texas, for instance. He'll join top-tier candidates Rudy Giuliani, John McCain, and Mitt Romney, and the lesser-known Jim Gilmore, Sam Brownback, Tommy Thompson, Tom Tancredo, and Duncan Hunter at the Ronald Reagan Library in California. All are hoping to wrap themselves in the Reagan mantle and avoid being painted by the war legacy of the current president. Well, joining us first from California is David Mark, senior political editor for Politico.com, which is co-sponsoring the debate with MSNBC. And David, I mentioned Ron Paul. Do you think we're going to see the same thing happen tonight that we did during the Democrats' debate, with the lower-tier candidates lobbying some fireworks to try to attract attention?
That's right. These second-tier candidates are the ones who have the most to gain from these kind of debates. It's the Romney, Giuliani, McCain, those types who really just don't want to make any big mistakes. It's these folks who otherwise are not going to get much national exposure who are going to try to use this opportunity to propel themselves into the national spotlight. Now, whether they're successful with that or not is an open question. It's pretty tough with 10 people standing there in a 90-minute debate.
Well, and you know, is the format going to be the same? In other words, that means about 10 minutes per person.
It is. It will be pretty similar. There will be no opening statements or closing statements. It will be just be questions from the moderators and from Internet participants. So in a sense, that's good because it gives more chance for just direct questions, less opportunity for filibustering by these candidates. But nonetheless, space is going to be pretty tight.
We understand there will also be computer software, you know, keeping track of the timing as there was in the Democratic debate. Well, who chose the site, the Reagan Library, which is interesting because California is one of the bluest, most Democratic-leaning states in the country?
Well, the site was put forward by former First Lady Nancy Reagan, who wants to use the Reagan Library not just as a museum, but a place to be forward-looking, have debates about public policy. I actually covered a speech there this past Saturday night by Senator Ted Kennedy, which is about as opposite politically as you can find from Ronald Reagan. So she's really trying to use the library as a way for as a forum for public affairs looking forward.
Well, where do the candidates stand in the polls nationally?
Well, depending which poll you look at, McCain is sometimes leading. Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, is up front. Romney is usually back in the second or third position. But those are generally the leaders right now. I would caution, though, against reading too much into any poll right now. Dynamics can change an awful lot between now and January 2008 when the first voting begins. Also, some of the methodologies on these polls can be a little bit suspect. So while they're interesting, I wouldn't say they're all that important right now.
But for some might say that John McCain has been seen as losing his front-runner status to Rudy Giuliani, and that rather than just, you know, holding ground, he needs to try to gain back ground. You know, has he been able to stop that slide, and might he try to, you know, do something tonight to leapfrog a little?
Well, I think he's going to try and present himself as the heir to the Reagan legacy, the true fiscal conservative, somebody who represents true Republican values, whatever his definition of that is. His problem has been fundraising on the one hand. His other problem has been tying himself so closely to the Bush administration over Iraq policy. Now, there is a constituency for that in the Republican primaries. The people who trudge through the snow to vote in Iowa and New Hampshire care deeply about a lot of these issues. So just because some of these positions are unpopular with the American electorate, broadly, in Republican primaries, these can still be very helpful.
We are going to talk to a Republican strategist, but this would seem to be the toughest row to hoe because, on the one hand, the other candidates in attacking John McCain run the risk of also attacking President Bush.
That's right, and it's really interesting to see how these candidates are trying to subtly distance themselves from President Bush without outright criticism of him. We've interviewed a number of these candidates going into this debate. Each brings up their own differences with Bush, whether it's on immigration policy, how they would have handled the Iraq situation, any number of other issues in which they don't want to come out and completely blast him, but they don't want to appear too close to him either. It's a really kind of fine line that they're walking.
Well, we just want to mention the Republicans have some actors waiting in the wings, in one case literally an actor, actor and former Tennessee Senator Fred Thompson, but also former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel. All are undeclared, but, you know, there's an anticipation, in some cases a hope, that they're going to get in the race. How much will that change the calculus?
Well, it's really interesting to see the specter of Fred Thompson hanging over the debate site right now. You hear a lot of chattering and buzz from folks inside who work inside politics about a prospective Fred Thompson candidacy. there seems to be a certain level of excitement about him, but there's also a bit of wondering, can this guy really stand up to a real race? It takes a lot of scrutiny to be able to go to run for president, and whether he really has the fire in the belly, that's still an unknown question. Right now, he can just run on his positives. Once you become a declared candidate, everything changes.
Well, not to mention that they'd have to remove several episodes of Law and Order, which he's in.
I think the production crews are waiting on pins and needles
right
to hear whether the show's going to continue.
David Mack, senior political editor for Politico.com, co-sponsoring tonight's Republican presidential debate with MSNBC. David, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, we turn now to Dan Schnurr, a Republican strategist who teaches political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Southern California. He was the communications advisor for John McCain in the senator's 2000 presidential race. And Dan, as we welcome you, we want to say you're not working for any 2008 presidential candidate, correct?
No, I'm not, Robin. I'm watching this one safely from the cheap seats.
So from those seats, just taking a quick look, who's got the most to lose and most to gain tonight?
Well, I mean, by definition, top tier of candidates always has the most to lose. So McCain and Giuliani and to some degree Romney are playing defense tonight, while the other, believe it or not, seven candidates who aren't particularly well known by the primary voters really don't have anywhere to go but up. So you'll see those second and third tier candidates doing everything they can to just grab a moment of the voters' attention, and the top three, McCain, Giuliani, and Romney, doing whatever they can to withstand the criticisms they're going to get from the rest of the field.
Well, let's do a quick lightning round. What does Mitt Romney have to say on accusations that he's a flip-flopper on social issues like gay marriage?
Basically, Mitt Romney needs to remind conservative Republican voters that he's with them now. And as long as he can come up with, maybe not tonight, but over the next weeks and months, a plausible explanation on why he's rethought these positions in the last few years, the important thing he'll try to convince conservative voters is that he's with them in 2008, regardless of where he was in 2004 and earlier.
What does he have to say if he is asked, and he probably will be asked, about his faith, which is Mormonism? He's reportedly said he's not going to take a John Kennedy-like stand defending and further calling attention to his Mormon faith. What will he say if he's asked tonight, for instance, if he will take orders from the head of the church?
Actually, if I were Mitt Romney, I'd hope to get a question like that, because unlike a more considered question about his religious faith, that's a relatively easy one to slap down pretty quickly. What good candidates of both parties do when they get asked a difficult question is they look for common ground with their audience. And so what Mitt Romney has begun to do, and I think will continue to do in the campaign, is looking in particular to reassure religious conservative voters that even though he goes to church in a different building on Sunday, his beliefs and his faith are very similar to theirs.
That's Dan Schnurr, Republican strategist, professor of political science, and former communications advisor for John McCain in the 2000 race. Not working with any candidate this time, but as we're hearing, he's got plenty of free advice for them. When we come back, more of our lightning round, what each candidate, in Dan's opinion, should say in response to expected questions. Quick note, later in the program, she's still dancing fabulously every night for 2 hours in high heels. Cheetah Rivera, back after a minute break, here and now. Young, it's here and now, and we're back with Dan Schnurr. He's a Republican strategist, not working with any candidate in the 2008 race, but he's got some thoughts for them in advance of tonight's debate at the Reagan Library. And Dan, let's pick up our lightning round with John McCain. What does he have to say when asked about his support for the war in Iraq, despite the call by voters to withdraw and despite the images every day that it's not going well?
My friend John McCain is in a tricky position because on one hand, he has been the administration's strongest and most visible supporter of the war. On the other hand, to be fair, he's been very, very critical, and from very, very early on, that the administration was not devoting enough troops to do the job there adequately. He's criticized Donald Rumsfeld. He's criticized Dick Cheney. He has criticized everyone except for Laura Bush, leading up to the president, in order to try to establish some distance while still being supportive. As you and your listeners saw in New Hampshire last week, McCain took a much more aggressive stance in terms of separating himself from the administration on a lot of issues in his announcement speech. He didn't do that as aggressively on Iraq. In essence, his message is, look, I don't like where we are either, but giving up is even worse.
What does he have to do to overcome the perception recently that he's just sort of flattened out, that he's lost some energy?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for McCain is not only to reassure conservative voters that he should be trusted by them, but to reinvigorate them. And to the extent that there's any message you can get across in a 10-candidate debate, I think what McCain will be trying to do more than any of the others is to let conservatives know that even though they don't agree with him on campaign finance reform and on immigration and on global warming, there's plenty of other issues where he and they do march together.
What about Giuliani? What does he have to say when asked, and he probably will be, about moving in with his lover before he was divorced, in fact, breaking up with his second wife on TV?
Well, my guess is that Rudy Giuliani's answer to every question is September 11th, 2001. And while he obviously can't answer very specific questions by changing the subject like that, his goal over the course of a 90-minute debate is to remind the primary audience as much as possible about that part of his biography.
That might also be the answer to another question he's sure to get, his lack of foreign policy experience.
It's the answer to every question. But to take your first point a little bit more seriously, Robin, is I think what you'll see him do is talk in broad terms about his values and talk about, but then maybe even admonish the moderator and say, listen, my personal life is private. Let's talk more broadly about the challenges facing this country.
Dan Schneur, again, a Republican strategist. So we want to ask you this question. The group of Democrats running for president is raising more money than the Republican candidates, and that's a change from the past. Polls show the number of Americans who call themselves Republicans has dropped to 1970s levels. But in the USA Today poll, while a generic candidate wins by 13 points over a Republican, just a Democrat, Hillary Clinton loses in a matchup with Rudy Giuliani by 5 points.
Well, I think there's a couple things going on there. One, number one, there's no question there's a real deflation in the Republican Party base right now. And in fact, George Will, the respected conservative commentator, has begun to speculate that the war on Iraq could have the same effect on the Republican Party over the long term that the Hoover presidency and the Great Depression did 80, 90 years ago. Hmm. And obviously that's not a parallel you want to follow too closely. But you know, Republicans, like other voters, are concerned about the war. And while some have shifted from party allegiance, others just tend to be a little bit more dispirited. And I think you see that in terms of fundraising, in terms of volunteer excitement. The other thing going on is that one party's held the White House for 8 years. In 1999 and 2000, if you remember, it was Republicans who were much more motivated with a much more interesting and invigorating field because we'd been out in the cold for 8 years. Now we've had the White House, we've gotten a little bit self-satisfied. The Democrats are hungrier, so it's only natural that they'd show a little bit greater level of enthusiasm. Getting something back is always a lot more exciting than trying to keep it.
One last question, Dan. In addition to Ronald Reagan's name and perhaps spirit infusing the event tonight, there's another Republican very much active, and he will also, I'm sure, either be visible or be thought of, and that's Arnold Schwarzenegger, California governor. You know, how much do you think his push to the center, his concentration on health care reform, global warming, instead of the issues of gay marriage, abortion rights, the war in Iraq, how much will that be sort of underscored by what the candidates say tonight?
Well, I don't think it'll have a great impact. Now, you know, Governor Schwarzenegger has identified himself as a post-partisan. And as a result of that, in a state like California, that's given him historically high popularity ratings. But as much as he would like to run for president, he cannot and is not. And for those Republicans in a primary field, their political objectives are somewhat different. Just as Democratic candidates have to figure out a way to reach out to the most fervent anti-war base in their party, Republican presidential candidates have got to figure out a way to reach out successfully to the most strongly held conservative voters in our party. While Schwarzenegger is very popular, his objective of reaching out to the center is very different than what the Republican primary candidates in the debate tonight have to do.
They are not running for president of California.
Exactly.
Dan Schneur, a Republican strategist who teaches political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Southern California. As we said, he was communications advisor for John McCain in the senator's 2000 presidential race, but he's got no dog in this one. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, when we didn't get to touch on the topic of hair. It became an issue when Democrat John Edwards was criticized for having two $400 haircuts and charging his campaign. He eventually paid back the campaign and said it was all an illustration of his theme, two Americas, the America of the rich and the one of the poor. Well, Republican Mitt Romney got this fashion advice from Jay Leno last night.
You don't get $400 haircuts, do you?
No. There are two Americas, you know.
Really?
Yeah. There's the one where you get $400 haircuts, and then there's everybody else's.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So.
But this is better than supercuts. This is a little...
It's a little long. I'm going to get a...
Oh, is that long
that's
now?
It's a little long. I'm going to get a cut before tomorrow's debate. Yeah.
Really?
Okay. Keep it long, huh? You think? Yeah. Well...
For the record, Romney says he gets his hair cut for $50, including tip. Perhaps the other candidates will disclose as well tonight. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, Edward Hopper's America, the diners, the lighthouses, storefronts. One, a drugstore with an X-Lax ad, will visit a new display of his artwork. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the walls of the world and how they seldom manage to keep people out. That's all after the news, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Lately, we've been hearing a lot about walls. Walls snaking through Jerusalem, through neighborhoods in Baghdad, and along the U.S. border with Mexico. That hodgepodge along the border comes to life in an article by journalist Chuck Bowden in the new issue of the National Geographic magazine. And while he explores those barriers, he reminds us of other walls in world history. Now, you might remember Chuck's been with us before to talk about the explosion in illegal immigration. He says it was caused by the North American Free Trade Agreement, the deal that was supposed to stem the tide, but he says instead it actually had the opposite effect, driving millions of Mexicans north illegally because their peasant economy was destroyed. Now he's back to talk about walls. He joins us from Arizona. Welcome back, Chuck.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be back.
And we want to tell our listeners you can follow along as we speak about walls by looking at the amazing photographs of walls along the U.S. border taken by Diane Cook and Len Genschel. That's at our website, here-now.org. But as I look at them, Chuck, they look like sculptures.
When you look at them in the magazine, they look kind of beautiful. Hmm. Of course, you're not trying to cross them.
Right. Or seeing them in your backyard from the U.S. side. To describe them, there's a steel mesh wall. Here's another one that looks like an old wooden Civil War fence, only it's made out of iron. I'm looking at a picture on a beach in San Diego. There's railway tracking that's jammed into the sand, and then it rises up horizontally to make a sort of fence. You write that people have different views of walls depending on what their needs are. What are those different views?
If you get in these border communities, walls make their life calmer. There's less noise of the Border Patrol having high-speed chases of illegal immigrants, etc. So in a way, it pacifies those communities. On the other hand, these towns have always been kind of welded together socially and economically, and they've kind of lived a fiction like they're, you know, one big border community, and now the wall makes them face the fact they're separate nations.
You write a wall turns a legal distinction, a border, into a virtual slap in the face. You can't overlook it.
I defy anyone listening to drive down to some of these communities and look at the wall and look at the search lights and not feel uncomfortable. I know it's a cliche, but you can't look at these things and not think, my God, this must have been what it was like in Berlin. And we're not like that, are we?
What is the historical context for this? You mentioned the Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall was an effort by the East German government to keep East Germans in East Germany, to keep them from leaving. The wall we're building on the border is to keep Mexicans and other people from entering our country illegally. In other words, we're trying to keep people out, not keep people in.
There's the Great Wall of China. Again, that was to keep tribes out.
Yeah, it was an effort to keep the Mongolian hordes out of China. And it worked until it didn't work, and then they wound up with a Mongol emperor. All walls worked for a while.
The Hadrian Wall in Scotland?
It was an effort to wall off Scotland from what we now call England. It was built by the Romans. You know, they decided these savage tribesmen to the north were too much to deal with, and it also worked
for a while. Right. As did the Maginot Line. This is the series of connected forts that was built by the French after World War I to keep the Germans from invading. It worked until the Germans did what?
Until they invaded. They just went around the end. Like, one of the focuses of the article in National Geographic is a tiny community called Naco, Arizona, which has 800 people, and the wall there is a little over 2 miles long, and it works perfectly fine. Nobody penetrates the wall. They just go to the end and then go around it to come in.
Naco, Arizona has a sister city of Naco, Mexico, on the other side of its wall. And at one time, apparently, they got along very well. You write about a man named Patrick Murphy who in 1929 tried to help rebels on the other side of the border in Mexico. What's their relationship now?
It's the same. I mean, they're all interrelated. They have relatives on each side. I went to a party on the line when I was doing the story. Half the people there were from the other side. What you have to realize, though, is for the people on the Mexican side, it's sort of psychologically hurtful because it reminds them they're not wanted, and so they'll all tell you that. But for everyday life, the wall doesn't make a bit of difference.
Really? Because you got the sense that people on both sides were constantly aware of it.
When you go to the border, everybody is realistic about illegal immigration, about the problem. They all realize it's an economic problem. And so they look at the walls, et cetera, as inevitable, but as having nothing to do with the problem. Get away from the border, then everybody has a solution and theories and big positions.
You write about another irony, that the wall is in many cases keeping illegal, undocumented immigrants in. They can't get back.
What we used to have, where people would come up here, work for a while, go back to Mexico. Nobody that I've ever met in Mexico really wants to live in Chicago. Mexicans are very patriotic. They love their country. Now with the wall, it's getting so difficult and expensive to go back and forth that they just stay here. At one point on the border, it cost $1,700 to cross. Within 6 months, it was up to $2,000. Now it's $3,000. Well, this makes a difference. People simply just stay in the United States. They don't go home again.
What about the people who live on the American side of the wall? You do talk to people who, even though they might have some ambivalence about how it looks, how it makes them feel to have it, it works for them because there's less garbage, less of everything that comes with the immigration.
Well, there's less crime. What you have to understand is if you live on the border, the migration, and this is probably the largest human migration going on Earth, the movement of the Mexican poor north, is happening in your yard. It's trampling across your lawn. It's going through your life. So it's not an abstraction. And so people, whether they're liberal or conservative, get a little testy. Mm. Nobody wants a life where they go to work and come home and find their home's been broken into by some poor person who needed food or this or that. People on the border are getting angrier and angrier.
But as you point out, there's ways to either climb over the fence, dig under the fence, or move down to where the fence ends and move the problem into another neighborhood that doesn't have a fence or a wall. Congress had authorized a 700-mile wall along that border. How far along is that?
They're starting to build it. But, you know, the border is over 1,800 miles. And if you build a wall 1,800 miles long, there would be guys out there every night with welding torches cutting holes in it. We would go bankrupt just to maintain it. The wall, in a sense, is inevitable because it allows politicians to tell their constituents they've done something, but it doesn't address the problem. The problem is we have a nation to the south full of poor people, and they want out. The wall just makes it more difficult for them to get here. They'll still come here.
Journalist Chuck Bowden, his story about the U.S.-Mexico border wall, walls, many walls, appears in the May issue of the National Geographic, and you can link to the story and see the pictures at our website, here-now.org. Chuck, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, and incidentally, if you want the perfect model of a wall, I mean, if you were really serious and you wanted to do this, we have one in our history, Alcatraz. If you want to create a country like Alcatraz, you can keep everybody out.
Didn't someone manage to swim away from that, too?
There's no proof that anyone ever escaped from Alcatraz. And certainly, we have no record of anybody trying to break into it.
Chuck, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come before we go today, she danced through the history of 20th century theater and beyond, Broadway legend Chita Rivera. You're listening to Here and Now.
Kentucky Derby.
Well, Saturday marks the 133rd Run for the Roses, the first jewel in horse racing's Triple Crown. Today's Morning Line favorites to win is a horse named Curlin, despite the fact that he's run only three races in his entire career. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. He joins us from Louisville to preview the Kentucky Derby. Welcome back, Joe.
Robin, how are you today?
I'm good, but I can't help but think, and others might be thinking as well, that last time you were here it was to mark the death of the great horse Barbaro. I want to talk more about that in a moment, but just your first thoughts, you know. And people do wonder, we don't follow horse racing, would he have run today if he hadn't been injured?
No, and that's the beauty of the Derby. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's for three-year-old horses. They're only three-year-olds once. You get one shot at it, and that's what makes his success so big. Why people fell in love with him. You know, the Derby winner is as big as it gets in horse racing.
Right. Well, we'll talk more about Barbaro, but, you know, this year's projected winner, Curlin. Now, in your story today, you describe him as untested but wickedly fast. Again, for those of us not in the know, how fast is wickedly fast?
He's so fast, Robin. No, really what he is, he's won by 10.5 lengths the last time out. He's won by a combined 30 lengths. He's just destroyed every field he's ever faced. The problem in that is he's only faced three fields. He didn't race as a two-year-old. The last horse that won the Derby who didn't race as a two-year-old was Apollo in 1882. The last horse to win after only three races was Regret, a filly, in 1915.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's very good, but nobody knows how good because they call it seasoning. He hadn't been behind horses where dirt got kicked in his face. He had certainly not faced a 20-horse field, which the Derby is. He's never been banged around. So those are the questions about the favorite.
Huh. And by the way, here in Boston, we don't say wickedly, we say wicked. Say wicked fast.
That's my Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, you write today that another horse is maybe going to be the favorite by post time, and that's a horse called Street Sense. What are his chances?
Street Sense is really the buzz horse down here. He's a big strapping thing, looks beautiful. He won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile last year by a record, again, 10 lengths, and thus was made two-year-old champion. He's trained by a guy named Carl Nasker, who won this race in 1990 with Unbridled. He is a stone-cold late runner. You're going to see him for the first time when they turn for home, and if all goes well, which it did at the same track last year, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile was here at Churchill, you see him gliding through the lane and galloping on out. So he's really, I think, the true favorite. Curlin's sort of the popular favorite.
Joe, just a quick response on this, because as we're hearing about, you know, horses getting perhaps jostled about and dirt kicked in their face, for those, you know, for people who don't follow it and cringe at that, you say these horses can't wait to get out of the gate.
They can't wait
to
get out of the gate. I mean, the thing, somebody told me to do this once, and I did do this. They said, go to the backside in their barns, and when they play the call to post, the trumpeter, look down the shed row. And sure enough, every horse sticks his head out. And he knows what that means and what he's supposed to do. Now, the kicking dirt in the face, there's nothing harmful about that. It's just when you have a bunch of horses running on the dirt, there's kickback.
There's dirt.
And the jostling is part of that, too.
Well, there's one horse that won't be looking out this year, and that's Barbaro. Again, broke a leg in the Preakness, had to be put down after a long fight. Will he be noted at this Kentucky Derby? Or?
You know, Robin, he will be noticed and honored, and in fact, controversially so. Yum Brands, which is the title sponsor of the Derby, has offered what they call a Barbaro bonus, and it's $1 million if the winner surpasses his margin of victory last year, which was 6.5 lengths. Now, it was really an ill-thought-out kind of thing because it gives the connotation that a jockey is going to try to run a horse harder to get the $1 million. Now, I know jockeys, and I don't think they will do that, but they could have come up with a better way to honor Barbaro.
Huh. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times, the author of also Black Maestro, the epic life of jockey Jimmy Wingfield. Well, that's something to think about, Joe. We will think about that. Perhaps there will be other honors down the road that might, you know, be more appropriate.
I would think so with the Preakness in Baltimore. There will be.
Right, where he was so injured. Joe, thanks always for speaking with us.
Robin, have a great day.
Still ahead, Broadway legend Cheetah Rivera, here and now. Young, it's here and now.
Anita's gonna get her kicks. Tonight, we'll have our private little mix. Tonight, we'll walk in hot...
The Broadway sensation West Side Story is about to celebrate 50. The woman who created the role of Anita is 74, and she still gets her kicks all the way up to her chin. And more. Her many fans say Chita Rivera not only created the role of Anita, she still owns it and others. Reading her bio is like paging through 20th century theater history. She was the original Rosie with Dick Van Dyke in Bye Bye Birdie, the original Velma in Bob Fosse's Chicago with Gwen Verdon as Roxy. Chita won her first Tony for The Rink, her second for Kiss of the Spider Woman. In 2002, she was honored at the Kennedy Center for her outstanding contributions to musical theater with a salute from a huge corps of dancers. That award was the genesis for her current show, Chita Rivera, The Dancer's Life, what one critic called a singing scrapbook. Backed by another corps of young dancers, all excellent but with half her panache, Chita honestly tells her life story. The parts lost, the loves lost, bleeding feet dancing for Balanchine, a broken leg after she was hit by a cab in her 50s. But she's still on stage. After a Broadway run, the show is touring. It's here in Boston where our interview began with a big, very strong hug from Anita herself.
Hi.
Hello. Oh, my turn. when we were told in the office that we were going to be talking to you, every woman in the office turned around from their desk and spat out, "A boy like that to kill your brother."
West Side Story. This is the original recording. We're about to hear both soundtracks and some of Chita's stage show. The West Side Story chapter of her life comes about midway through her first act. Are you aware of what happens when you're on stage in the theater when those notes strike out, the first notes of West Side Story? Can you feel what happens in the audience?
Yeah, I can. When it happens, you hope before that it's going to happen. And when it does, it's like a wonderful cushion. It's like a wonderful, warm feeling all over you that you share with those people who remember.
You just said that you, before the moment in the audience where they, the room becomes electric when they realize West Side Story is coming, you say you hope it happens. 50 years later and you still don't count on it? You still don't know?
I'm telling you, I'm a person that takes nothing for granted. I don't want to be disappointed, you know, but then there's the other thing. If someone, that's why the theater is so wonderful, because you teach, you introduce. And so when there are younger people who maybe never saw it, the thing that I am positive of is that it's brilliant.
And they will learn, too, that it almost didn't happen. You go through the audition process, you know, in the room, the greats like Leonard Bernstein. Can you just share a little bit of that now?
Sure. Well, it was a big audition, you know, and so they finally get down to X amount of people. And so the great man I had to sing for, and he wanted me to learn A Boy Like That, and... You know, I exaggerated a little bit in the theater, but I wasn't learning the notes. Actually, I learned that song, really, sitting next to him on the piano stool.
And in that moment, as you made clear, I mean, you were hitting some of the wrong notes. The Anita role wasn't a guarantee, and it's a very powerful statement when you go through that audition, when you tell the audience what happened.
I got the job, yeah.
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another. One of your own kind, stick to your own kind. A boy like that will bring you sorrow.
You're also very honest about the fact that you created the role of Anita, and yet Rita Moreno got the film part, and you're very honest on stage that you wanted to kill her.
Well, the truth of the matter is, I was in Philly with Bye Bye Birdie, with Dick Van Dyke, and... They spoke to me. I had signed a contract with Brett. I am so grateful that it didn't happen. Because I wouldn't have done Bye Bye Birdie. I wouldn't have met Dick Van Dyke and worked with him. It was a huge success, Bye Bye Birdie. And I guess I was destined to really stay in the theater.
Now my life is rosy.
All will be happy, I know.
Since I found my Rosie.
Off to the creature we'll go.
With a girl like Rosie.
So how could we be blue? Oh, we'll have.
Another part of your show that we want to make sure we touch on is a long section where you acknowledge all the great choreographers that you've worked with, Jack Cole, Bob Fosse, Peter Gennaro, who, as you said, created two of the dances in West Side Story, didn't get credit.
Well, he did America, and he did the Sharks, for the Puerto Rican section of the gym, the dance of the gym. And he's never been given the proper recognition for it. And I actually give time. I just move back to give some air in there for somebody that knows about Peter doing that. Because it's a huge thing.
To applaud him.
To applaud him. And when that happens, it just makes me crazy. I'm so happy.
Nobody's feet were faster than Peter Gennaro's, except maybe mine when I danced with him. People said we had two of the greatest bums in show business.
You are so generous in this show. It's you're telling your story, but it's also the story of the choreographers of Gwen Verdon, one of the great dancers, your partner in her Roxy to your Velma in Chicago.
Right. She was my idol. I was in California with my daughter, Lisa, and I got the call from my great friends, Fred Ebb and John Cantor, and they said, would you come to New York? Bobby and Gwen want you to do Chicago with Gwen. Well, I couldn't believe that. And I came, and the fact that I was actually standing, I was standing behind her, and we were doing two dancing as one, and we had to be absolutely identical. And I went, oh my goodness, I am standing next to Gwen. She says that she was saying, oh my goodness, I'm standing next to Gina.
And that's good. Isn't it grand? Isn't it great? Isn't it swell? Isn't it fun?
At one point, I think it's describing Anita, you say, you know, it was the right play, right part. It was just that chemical thing. And as I was watching, I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is the right part. The part of you is...
You see, now you're going to make me cry, because that's what life is all about. I think there's a big old book up there, and that it's all written. And you just have to listen and to see and to feel, and it all falls into place. And you're absolutely right on the nose. I'm supposed to be doing this right now. And it happened when I looked at that stage and saw those 40 dancers hit it at the Kennedy Center. And I went, huh? That's what I'm supposed to do. Represent them. Not tell my story, but represent them. And it's great. I'm glad you saw that.
Well, some of us could try to do the same thing and we wouldn't be able to kick our knee to our head.
That's not what you do. You're right. You speak, you share. You communicate. It's all about communication. It's all about getting along with one another. And
you have a little tear.
Yeah. Well, I saw you well up too. Yeah. Life is a fascinating thing. And I say in the show, Betty Davis said, old age isn't for sissies. Well, the better line of the two doesn't get as much response. The following line is, neither is life.
Chita Rivera, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I can die now.
She takes it back. She takes it back.
Come on, babe. Why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz.
Chita Rivera singing All That Jazz from the musical Chicago. For more on Chita and her show, Chita Rivera, The Dancer's Life, go to our website, here-now.org.
Start the car. I know a whoopee spot where the gin is.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Where there's a nightly brawl and all of that. Yeah.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.